Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:06 PM and that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is April 21st. I thought we'd kick off and look at some of the supply inelasticity candidates that we have out there at present, and certainly palladium is filling in that gap. When we think about some of the difficulties that Norilsk Nickel has been having in some of its mines, then that is certainly helping to create a supply inelasticity, or at least a short-term shortage of palladium. One thing, of course, is that the more nickel that is produced, then the more palladium that will be produced as a byproduct. And there are significant plans underway to expand nickel production because of its role in battery production. So this continued advance that we're seeing in palladium is a significant ramping up of enthusiasm since the last time it tested the region of the trend mean. Back then it was looking pretty ropey. We had a lengthy period of consolidation. We'd had a very significant pullback in early 2020, and then it popped on the upside. So this is a reassertion of the medium-term uptrend, and in the absence of a countervailing or countermanding downward dynamic, then we would have to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. So we certainly still have evidence of short-term supply problems that are cropping up in a whole range of different sectors. And the other big one, of course, is lumber, where we've had this phenomenal advance, but we had a downside key reversal yesterday. So that at least marked a peak of near-term significance, but we did not have downside follow-through in here today. The price did gap lower, but it has not followed through, at least not yet, on the downside. But we've seen a phenomenal acceleration. But it's not because there's a lack of trees. In fact, there's plenty of trees, and the price of timber itself hasn't, in fact, increased. All of the spread here between the value of the cut timber and the finished product is being picked up by the sawmills. So when we think about, for example, West Fraser timber in Canada, then they are the kinds of sawmills that are picking up this kind of premium. But while we did not have downside follow through on lumber today, we did have downside follow through for some of these lumber companies. So that would suggest that investors are beginning to take some of the money off the table following a really quite incredible acceleration on the upside. So we may be coming towards the end of that short-term supply squeeze. Then when we think about Taiwan Semiconductor, I continue to see the commentary on just how acute the pressure is on Taiwan right now because of its drought. And for a subtropical island to have a drought is something they're not particularly accustomed to. And I certainly know, coming from Ireland, where it rains every other day at the minimum, then there is a tendency to take water for granted. But certainly Taiwan Semiconductor's stock is no longer rising. And it looks like we are due a consolidation. We're getting it, certainly, and there is the potential that we could see a deeper process of consolidation unfolding. This shortage of semiconductors, again, is a reasonably short-term problem, because there eventually this supply-demand mismatch will be ironed out and we will get back to some semblance of normal. But it takes a while. So I was watching a webcast today from, let me just get the I'm terrible with names, so I do apologize, but it was from Richard Bernstein, and he was making the comment that when we compare the oil embargo back in the 1970s, well, these supply inelasticities are similar to that. Of course, the big difference is that oil is absolutely integral to the entire global economy. Lumber futures aren't. Now, quite whether we're going to see a similar kind of condition arise with inflation and semiconductors. I don't think that there is really quite the same comparison. And then, of course, there is the additional problem that the oil embargo in the 70s was politically motivated. It was a revolt against the devaluation of the dollar. And we don't quite have the same conditions going on right now. This isn't a revolt against anything, and there are clear efforts underway to try and ameliorate the situation for short-term supply issues. And of course, that is why the Federal Reserve believes that inflation is going to be transitory, that they believe that these supply disruptions are going to be reasonably short-term in nature. But then, of course, we have other supply shortages, and copper is emblematic of that. So the copper price was firm again in here today, and it is continuing to push up and through lateral resistance in the region of the upper side of this short-term range. So it's right in the region of the peak now, and there's not much to question that this isn't a consistent trend. We have a series of ranges, one above another. Each of the ranges is reasonably similar, and there is clear distance between each of them. So we've got a steep and consistent advance, and there's also a little bit of commonality in the duration of the ranges. They're about a couple of months apiece. So it's quite likely that we're going to see a clear break on the upside by copper. And the supply inelasticity argument for copper is not something that can be easily brought under control. Developing copper assets takes decades, and a number of the bigger projects that are still underway are not quite yet ready for fruition. So we could be in for a lengthy period of investment in significant new sources of demand. We've certainly seen a lot of investment and technological expertise brought to bear on the shortage of nickel, and the price hasn't moved to nearly the same extent. Well, I think that's a clear representation of the fact that it might be more polluting to develop nickel, but it's easier overall. And I think that's also one of the factors that will contribute to the eventual demise of palladium. Of course, what we're also seeing are factors right now that are important in terms of the lack of supply of new vehicles, the lack of supply of new houses, and that is driving upward demand for all manner of fixed assets. That's certainly been one of the primary bullish characteristics behind Bitcoin, that it is a hedge against the devaluation of currencies. But I think it's also important to highlight that we have a very significant loss of momentum, and the price right now is steadying around the 50-day moving average. The 50-day moving average is, generally speaking, the one that momentum traders favor most. So when we think about, well, what exactly are they doing right now? Well, there will certainly be some people that will want to buy the dip, and they've been doing that over the course of the last 3 days. Now, if you were buying the dip and against a background of a loss of momentum, and then also these very large downward dynamics and failed upside breaks, and you haven't been conditioned to deal with failed upside breaks for a year at least, then what do you do? Well, the majority of those people that are buying the dip might be encouraged to have a stop, and those stops are going to be somewhere in the region of about 53,000. So they may be just around the 51,000 level, or there might also be some stops around 50,000. But I think the first range of stops will be somewhere around the 53 area. And if you wanted to short it, then coming in size and pressuring some of those would probably be an effective strategy. And if we see a pullback below a significant pullback below the 50-day moving average, well, then the chances are that the next area of potential support is around the 200-day moving average, and that's a $20,000 decline from where prices are right now. And if this turns into a crash similar to what we had back in 2017-18, well, then it would be logical to anticipate that the price would come back all the way down to the $15,000 level, which is the 1,000-day moving average. And even then, that would be a smaller pullback than we've seen from Bitcoin in other crash scenarios. I think one thing that's really quite interesting right now is the fact that Ethereum has been really quite firm, and it has rebounded impressively over the course of the last 2 days. Now, it would be tempting to think that because Ethereum is still strong, then gold will inevitably, or excuse me, that Bitcoin will inevitably rebound. Because I would generally anticipate that the fact that silver, for example, has been so firm and is now bouncing from the region of the trend mean and has held up much better than gold, that's a positive sign for gold overall. And I think that's the case. But the rationale for coming to that conclusion is because silver is high beta gold, and in the second and third psychological perception stages of the bull market, it does outperform gold. And we have plenty of evidence for that. And because it's high beta gold and it responds to many of the same cues, then we should anticipate that it would be a high beta play. And we also know that when it accelerated all the way up to its peak around $50, then both gold and Ethereum and silver, excuse me, peaked around the same time. But that's not what happened with Bitcoin and Ethereum in 2017. Bitcoin peaked 3 weeks before Ethereum, and Ethereum continued on to new highs all the way through until the middle of January 2018, even though Bitcoin had peaked towards the end of December in 2017. And Bitcoin, and I did produce this chart, so it's probably instrumental if or probably useful if I pull it up. And let's bring that over here. We can see that this is a significant outperformance of Bitcoin, which ended in December. Then Ethereum, in fact, outperformed really quite impressively all the way through until February. So even though Ethereum had peaked, it did not fall as quickly as Bitcoin did initially. And then as Bitcoin's bear market took hold and investors gave up on the possibility of a quick advance to new highs, well, then they started liquidating all of their holdings in the altcoins as well, and then Ethereum really did decline in a very big way relative to Bitcoin. So I am rather wary of Ethereum right now. And I think it is also rather interesting that as some of the heat comes out of the cryptocurrency markets, we're starting to see gold picking up again. And it's now right in the region of the $1,800 area. And I anticipate that we are going to at least get back up towards the $1,860 area before we see any meaningful sign of resistance. And that would be reasonable to anticipate because we've had more than $100 rallies from the big psychological levels of $1,900, $1,800, and now $1,700 over the course of the last 7 or 8 months. But the other point is that we do have something of a supply inelasticity argument for the precious metals, and it is not something that is about to disappear overnight. The hurdles for building new mines just continue to grow, and the arguments about the environmental consequences of mining and even the need for gold mining, they continue to rage. And as we see these arguments increase, then the difficulty of starting new mines and the surety that's required about resources and proofing up the reserves before a new mine can be built, those hurdles are just going to become progressively higher. So little wonder then that gold miners are still really quite active in M&A activity, because it's about surety. When a mine already exists, well, then you've already got over all those regulatory hurdles, and that commands a premium. So when we think about gold miners, well, they're not investing in greenfield or practically even brownfield new supply. And that means that we have supply inelasticity meets rising demand. And as long as the mining sector is thinking more about their balance sheets and cash flows rather than going out and borrowing a ton of money and blowing it on digging holes all over the world, well, then that's really positive for for the stock market investor as well. One thing that I thought was interesting was watching Hockaday's or reading over the transcript of Hochschild Mining's quarterly report in here today. The number of times they said good, I thought was quite interesting. And the estimated P is coming down to 11 from 114, and they have a yield of about 2.25. And silver prices, they're a major silver producer, are starting to firm up in here. And they have come through the coronavirus supply issues in with flying colors, and the price is hovering here around the 200p level. And this is the kind of value that we see in a substantial proportion of the gold mining sector. What I found also interesting in here today is that the Canadian dollar is strengthening again, and I think it is probably a better way of looking at it is the other way around, so that we have a clear view of what the base looks like. Because this looks like a 6-year-old base. We had the failed breakdown to new lows in March 2020, and subsequently we've gone right back up to test the upper side of the base, and it's quite likely that we're going to see a break on the upside. Before we move on and look at some of those other currencies, I think it is worth reminding ourselves that the TSX Materials Index has got a large number of gold miners in there, and it has a striking similarity with the pattern that we have on GDX. Of course, commodity-related currencies continue to rebound because commodity prices, everything from the industrial resources to precious metals, continue to do well. The profitability of miners will also be bolstered by the fact that oil prices are not surging on the upside. And then we can think about the fact that these currencies have been going sideways for most of the last 6 years, and they're increasingly seeing their economies move into expansion once more. And that's, I think, rather important, because one of the primary reasons why investors were willing to favor the resources currencies during the commodity bull market is because of the massive effect that commodity exports had on their current accounts. So they turned into creditor nations, and they were funding, or they were able to fund significant interest rate differentials. And in a zero interest rate world, the potential for a significant commodity-led bull market, as liquidity is poured into infrastructure projects, well, then that could really be quite beneficial for a large number of these commodity exporters. The South African rand, for example, is now firming from the region of its trend mean. Then we can think about some of the more volatile currencies and those that are more geopolitically constrained, like the Russian ruble is firming from the lower side of its base, and the Brazilian real is looking quite similar, and at least they're not breaking on the downside. And we've had really quite profound bear markets for some of these currencies over the course of the last decade. So if we do continue to see a bull market in the industrial resources and the agricultural commodities, then that's likely to be really very beneficial for these resources currencies as well. And of course, then the other potential supply and elasticity argument is with regard to the agricultural commodities. There's a significant drought brewing in the western half of the USA, and that's likely to have a deleterious effect on crop health. So it's likely to benefit soybeans, and it could quite easily be the missing ingredient to a catch-up play on wheat. And wheat prices have first step above the base characteristics and continue to have this rounding characteristic overall. So there is ample potential here that we're going to see wheat starting to push on the upside as well. Well, that generally then would suggest that it's the resources sector, which does tend to be highly cyclical, is likely to benefit and continue to benefit as we see this change evolving. At the other end of the spectrum, well, then we have companies like Netflix, did spectacularly well in 2020 and has gone nowhere for the last 9 months, and came back in a very dynamic manner in here today. Then we have some of the other stay-at-home candidates like Peloton, which is breaking down now, and not least because their treadmills are killing children. And then my opprobrium for Zoom Media really knows no bounds, but at least the share hasn't broken down below the $300 area. But I continue to think that this is just not a product that is going to survive beyond reopening. The other, I think, big point though is that the cloud computing sector is at least steadying in the region of the trend mean, and it has a striking commonality with the IPO sector, which is also steadying from the region of the trend mean. But they're not, these two asset classes are not trading individually. The reality is that a large number of the constituents of the IPO index, well, they use the products provided by the cloud computing sector. And most of these new companies have outsourced their back ends to the cloud. So a large part of the cloud revenue that companies like Amazon and Google and Microsoft are gaining comes from these champions in the IPO sector. And if we do start to see some of the heat coming out of IPOs, then that will have a material effect on the companies like Amazon in the future. But as long as they're bouncing from the region of the trend mean, which remains the case, then it's likely to continue to represent a tailwind for some of these bigger companies. So Amazon is now right in the region of the upper side of its range. Google has been investing in a lot more than cloud, so it has other business units to rely on, and the share remains in a clear, although steep, uptrend and probably susceptible to some pause and consolidation. And Microsoft has also been really resurgent on the upside as well. So these cloud companies and the big providers of cloud infrastructure are certainly among the continued strong performers in this market, even as some of the stay-at-home companies come under pressure. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.